Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another amazing episode of the Gals of Geekdom podcast. I am your host, Crystal Williams, and I'm joined with my equally amazing and talented and funny and smart co-hosts, Jazzy and Lizzie.
Hi.
That's not what you were saying about me earlier.
That was off the show. You're supposed to not fucking talk about
that. Why do you lie to the audience, Crystal? Why do you lie?
Jazzy, what happened to being out of earshot? What happened to that? I can hear you.
Wow.
I mean, just don't tell them that I'm secretly a unicorn. Fuck. And before we get too much into
things. We all know that you're a narwhal. Stop.
Yes, I'm a narwhal. Yes. That song was written about me. And before we get too off topic, we have a very special guest. You may know them from their show.
The Count. Wow. Wow. We have a very
sorry, I choked on something. We have Vera Wild with us today. Welcome to our show.
I did not get nearly as many superlatives as everyone else did. You know what? I think I'm going to leave. We'll wrap it up here. It was a lovely thought. No, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on the show. I'm sorry for my momentary slip up. And the fucked up thing is I don't edit the show, so people are going to hear everything that I messed up.
They'll hear lots of things. Lots of things.
Speaking as someone with a history of very lightly editing a very large percentage of my work that is publicly viewable, I get it.
We just vibe with whatever mistakes we make.
In all seriousness, I actually I do watch your videos and follow them. I have been kind of a fan for a bit. It's nice to have another trans creator talking about geek stuff and also very important stuff. Trans issues and all that. It's one of the reasons why I reached out to you, because I was like, you're super cool, maybe you'll be on. And thank you for being on.
You're welcome for being super cool. I am indeed that thing.
You're all that thing. Yeah.
Speaking of being a thing.
Oh, okay. Are we moving? Is this how we segue into our first segment?
Yeah, it's how I've always done it. So I've always found lame segues into these sections.
When have we ever had good segues on this show?
No, we've never had any.
I think there might have been like one or two during the Fast and Furious ones where like the topic was on cars or something that did actually relate to the movie.
Speaking of family,
well, that is actually a good segue, because Fast and Furious is a really deep piece about found family when you think about it.
It's also very unintentionally and slightly intentionally gay.
Oh, very. So yeah, Furious 7. So
it's shifting gears then.
That was good. That was good. I'm gonna use that next week.
And this is why I'm a professional.
Apparently. Sorry to disappoint you.
Look, I'm a professional at voice acting. I never said I was a professional at hosting a bloody podcast, so.
We've gotten pretty fucking good at it.
Yeah. But anywho, Furious 7!
Furious 7.
So, the last few films, like, so the last couple films, if you've been listening to pretty much every episode at this point, the last couple films I really enjoyed, and that was surprising to me considering I was pretty overall mixed on the first four. In fact, I gave Fast and Furious 6 out of a perfect 10 out of 10 rating, because then again, that was because one character who was played by a raging transphobe got hit by a car and then harpooned out a window, so that was kind of comfort food for me. So
that's always worth at least one or two points.
Yeah. So Furious 7, I was kind of interested in this one from the get-go, but I was also simultaneously dreading it. Interested because this one was directed by James Wan, who I know for the original Saw, Aquaman, and just he hasn't made movies that I downright love, but I genuinely like seeing what he makes. Like, so when I saw that he was attached to a Fast and Furious movie, I was like, okay, this will be cool. But I was also dreading it because I was aware that this was the last film that Paul Walker did, as he died during production. So I knew I was going to have my heart shattered, and I fucking did. So
yeah, that was my experience in the theater when it happened.
I'll say overall, I think this one isn't as good as the last two. I think it was actually kind of uneven in places, like even more so than I get from Fast and Furious.
I got to jump in here for a second.
Yes.
It's Justin Lin is the director, not James Wan.
No, Justin Lin directed the last four, but Seven was directed by James Wan.
Oh, nope, you're right. That is the only one he jumped in on. Okay.
Yeah, because I believe he was.
See, I've lost count because I haven't seen any of these. So you said Seven. I'm like, is the somewhere up in there? Whatever.
Right, right.
This is why we double check before we correct each other.
Yeah. And this is why I will never be asked on again.
No, you can always come back on our show.
You can always come embarrass yourself. It's fine.
No, I'm gonna be the one to embarrass myself.
But anyway. I thought the film was a little bit uneven, even though I did have a blast watching it. It was just there was a noticeable, it felt noticeably less than the last two movies, if that makes sense. And not that it wasn't trying to do something more. There was clearly kind of this, even without what was added late in production, there was kind of this dark edge to it compared to the other movies.
Do you think that's because it was James Wan taking over the film that Justin Lin had kind of already gotten comfortable in making?
Yeah, I think so. And don't get me wrong, they had some good fucking ideas with this movie. I'm gonna say this. It's not a bad movie. I wouldn't even say it was mediocre. It was quite good. I just don't think it was as like high octane and fun as the previous two. Like, and even then, I found some of the character moments to be kind of a mixed bag. I liked some of it, didn't like others. I don't know. I can't explain why this movie wasn't as good for me as the previous two. It just wasn't. Actually, I will say one is that it felt like certain characters were kind of not doing as much this time. Like, they like Hobbs, he gets his arm broken in like the first 10 minutes and then he's out of commission until the climax.
Who is Dwayne Johnson?
Yeah, character. Dwayne Johnson. Yeah, that was Dwayne Johnson. Though I will admit, the fact that he flexes his broken arm back to normal is the best fucking thing ever.
Yeah.
Well, there is a reason why he's kind of somewhat sidelined.
Yes.
Behind
the scenes reasons.
It was this was when like Vin Diesel and The Rock were not getting along, right?
No, they had big arguments on the set.
And they still aren't. I mean, this is part of the reason they spun him off into his own thing so that they didn't have to try and get these two to work together anymore.
That's why Hobbs is not an 8 or 9.
I thought he was an 8.
Nope. He's gone.
He is? Really? I could have sworn I saw him on one of the fucking ads for it. I could have sworn he was an 8.
I would not put it past the studio to put him in the ad.
Oh, wait. You never mind. I think he is an 8.
I know he's not 9, but...
Yeah, like, he's an 8. Never mind. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
So he's not a 9. That's what it is.
Yeah. So, I don't know. But it felt like they kind of just had a very cheap reason for him just not being there. And I'll also say, I didn't think the villain was as strong this time, despite the fact that it's Jason fucking Statham.
Don't worry, he gets better.
Yeah, the spinoff helps. You know?
Yeah, I have no doubt that, like, since he's in other movies in this franchise, there'll probably be more opportunities for him to grow on me. But as far as this movie where he's playing this antagonistic role, I didn't find him that interesting, and it's because he and this other guy, whose name I forget, were constantly at odds with each other for the role of antagonist, and I honestly don't remember who the other guy even was. Like,
I can't think, but to be fair, I haven't seen the movie since like well, theaters.
It felt like they added this other guy who I think was a leader of a terrorist organization. It felt like they added him because they didn't have enough faith in the plot with Shaw as the villain, despite the fact that you have enough material for him to be the villain.
Jason Statham.
Yeah, right? And not only that, but even ignoring the actor, like in the last movie, they're the reason his brother, who was the villain in the last one, is comatose. And he goes all out, goes to kill all of them. We find out he's the reason Han in the third movie is dead. And now we're finally fucking caught up with where Tokyo Drift was in the timeline. That was a fun diversion.
So to explain a little bit, the Fast and Furious franchise is unique in that the third entry happens after 6. So chronologically, even though you can look back and see the cars and the phones and the time.
Yes, yeah. It's just flip phones became in again for a bit.
Yeah.
In Tokyo for a hot minute.
In Tokyo, Japan.
But they're not known for riding the edge of technology.
Right?
No, Japan has always been very behind technologically from the United States.
But the point I'm trying to make is... Okay, so you have this entire deal where Shaw wants revenge on the other characters, and now the other characters want revenge for killing Han. You already have a fucking decent setup for a plot right there. You didn't need the terrorist shit.
Apparently they decided they needed a James Bond plot on top of everything else.
Even though Shaw is already kind of a James Bond villain. Oh my god, he's like an ex-MI6 agent, I believe was his established story.
Yeah, I do like 7, but obviously not as much as I liked 6. And right. I'm glad we agreed that 6 is really good. I thought I was the only one who loved 6.
Oh no, 6 was fucking fantastic, and I don't expect anything to beat it, especially with how that, now we have, like, I'll say this. Despite the fact that I did find the movie flawed, I do think, like, the last 5 minutes where they pretty much say goodbye to Paul Walker and retire his character, that was phenomenal. That was legitimately great.
It's because they really did care for Paul.
Right, and just,
you can tell these people who have been working with him for, I would, probably 10+ years at that point, right?
Like
this is their friend and colleague who is now passed away.
Yeah, Vin Diesel has a monologue at the end of the movie, which felt so fucking genuine, and it no doubt was. Like, and I was crying the entire time. I was losing it. That was, and the fact that I cried over a Fast and Furious movie, Jesus Christ.
I think everyone did who was invested in those movies.
The
at
cheesy
that point.
Car movie made me cry.
The car explosion cheesiness, yes.
So I'll say that was fantastic, but I also gotta say, I'm a bit worried going forward, because, no lie, despite the real-life tragedy that caused this ending to exist, this was kind of an awesome way to, well, not awesome necessarily, but kind of an effective way where you could have ended the entire franchise here, honestly. I think if this was like the final movie, people wouldn't have complained.
At this point, I don't think you should look at these movies as necessarily like going to have an ending. This is going to be Universal's Marvel Cinematic Universe.
And that's fair. And don't get me wrong, I'm still looking forward to the other movies. It's just, I guess I'm kind of a bit worried on how they will be going forward, because, like, a lot of what made the really good films in this franchise great is just generally the back, like, one big element was, of course, the back and forth between Vin Diesel and Paul Walker, and now one of them's dead, and, like, the franchise goes on without him, and I'm wondering... I have no doubt they'll find a way to make it interesting. I mean, the director of the next film did Straight Outta Compton, which I already find fucking promising just by that fact alone.
Yes, F. Gary Gray did that one, yes.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to it. but I'm also skeptical. As for this film, I enjoyed it a lot, and it made me cry.
I will say this, 8 and 9 definitely aren't as strong as 5, 6, and 7. Yeah, but they do have fun elements, and they bring back certain characters, and they do some interesting things, and I won't spoil for you.
Right, and we have three fucking movies left. This entire marathon has been going on for so long, because not only do we have 8 and 9, but between the two, we have Hobbs and Shaw, so...
Yeah.
And, like, there will be more. Until you mentioned it, I'd forgotten that this is Universal. They will never let this die, because Universal doesn't have a lot of franchises right now.
No, they need this franchise.
Yeah, no. And these movies make a shit ton of money, so.
I'm glad you overall enjoyed it. This and Jurassic World is them, too, I think.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, but they can't crank those out at a regular pace. That's why they tried to do the Dark Universe thing.
Also, Jurassic World is shit.
I think this is a
Yes, there's that too, but they make a lot of money.
I know. I just like pointing out that Jurassic World was shit.
I would have been so here and so hyped and so ready for a reimagined version of the classic Universal monsters, because I fucking love those old movies. Bride of Frankenstein is one of my favorite movies ever made. I'm planning on getting a bride tattoo.
Did anybody here actually see The Mummy with Tom Cruise?
No.
I did.
It didn't look good. I think Lindsay Ellis put it really well, and maybe it was her or someone else. I don't remember. I think it was her. She put it really well, where she mentioned that, like, who does this movie appeal to? It has no genre to describe it with, and it has, like...
I never saw The Mummy with Tom Cruise, but I have to say the only thing I remember it is that time they released the trailer that where it didn't have the music or sound effects and just the dialogue.
Yeah, and he's in the plane, the scratch, and it's just him screaming with no ambient effects, and his yell sounds
that
really
was the
weird.
Best that trailer was the best comedy of the year.
Oh man, so I did see the movie. Out of curiosity for sure, and I'm not gonna disagree and say it is a bad movie, but there are things I kind of enjoyed in a, like, this is cheesy and I kind of like the direction they want to go, just for the pure fact they were trying to set up their connected universe. they invented their own version of S.H.I.E.L.D., which was hilarious.
Right, like, and Nick Fury was fucking Dr. Jekyll.
Yes, Nick Fury is Dr. Jekyll. And you do see Mr. Hyde in it for a little bit. And that was Russell Crowe's character.
And of course, like, here's the thing that's really sad about that whole project. While, yes, Universal retains some rights to the specific ways they did these characters before, all this shit's in the public domain.
It is public domain owned.
Literally,
yeah.
Any studio, if they wanted to be assholes, could take that concept and do it themselves and make it work, just to make Universal look even worse.
And to Universal's credit, instead of sticking to their guns with their, like, entire universe planned, they decided to just use what they had, Jurassic World and Fast and Furious, and try to build upon that. But at least we got the modern version of the Invisible Man out of it, because holy shit, that movie's great.
Oh my fucking god, that was so goddamn good.
I do still need to see that.
You really should. It's really good.
I still need to see it.
That's
too.
Part of what upset me so much, though, is I was like, listen, if your vision for the new Universal Monster movies had been more in line with that, it would have been such an amazing series, whether they were interconnected or not. It would have been, yes, just remake these movies this way. But no.
Well, I mean, you realize Guillermo del Toro already gave us the best possible upgrade of
Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah.
Holy shit, yes. Well, exactly. That's what I want. Give me Guillermo del Toro's Creature from the Black Lagoon. Give me the new version of The Invisible Man. Like, give me... These are how I want you to remake the movies, these movies, which is you taking the premise and you're like, okay, what new and interesting thing can I mine from this?
It's similar. Honestly, I would also just compare it to the 1990s version of the Mummy remake with Brendan Fraser.
Yeah.
Which, while a vastly different type of movie than either of those, I think fits in much more harmoniously with it, and in the spirit of, we took a basic bare bones version of the premise, you pulled something that was interesting from that movie, and made something new and interesting out of it. And that's the purpose remakes should serve, to me, at least.
Right, it was interesting because the Brendan Fraser film was more or less kind of going for an Indiana Jones type film, so.
I want more of that so badly. I really wanted Disney's Jungle Cruise to have that vibe. So I have this giant, part of the reason why I love Indiana Jones and the Mummy and stuff like that, I have this extreme affinity for, like, turn of the century adventure films.
Mm-hmm. Colonialism.
I was just gonna say, I always will give my big white apology a caveat of the fact that these are colonialist fairy tales. They're like steeped in horrible, horrible racism, and that's part of why I really want to see more. Part of why I want to see the genre come back, because I want to see how we can maybe interrogate that about the genre a little bit. And. Mm-hmm. Delve into it, because that it's a frustrating thing about that genre is that I love it. It fills my heart with a lot of joy, and it's exciting and adventurous, and they're also constantly so racist, so unnecessarily racist.
See, the problem is, while you can definitely dial back on the overt racism, I don't think you can actually divorce that kind of adventure film from racism in general. It's baked into the premise.
You're correct.
The whole idea of finding these civilizations and people haven't seen this. Well, yeah, they fucking have, just not white people.
you're completely right. So an example I love to point to for movies that handled this really interestingly is, and these are gonna just don't make fun of me. There's Road to El Dorado.
Fucking love it.
Yeah.
I think it's a great example of how that's a movie kind of fundamentally about, like, you need to come at it from the perspective of the fact that the imperialists are the bad guys. And that needs to be how you frame your story, right? That's very much what the Road to El Dorado did. Is it was like, we are not the Spanish conquistadors are the, like, unambiguously the bad guys of the film.
Evil Jim Cummings over here.
Yeah. And then actually kind of recently, I don't know if y'all ever saw the live action Dora movie.
Not yet.
No, I missed that one.
I loved it. I know, like, it, like,
I actually heard it's like, it's really good.
It was really good. It was a really great family movie. It would have been my shit so hard when I was a kid. I had a lot of fun with it. It did a really good job of that too. By really, like, having all, like, it wasn't about El Dorado, but it was about finding, like, a lost city of gold that is totally not El Dorado, but it's a lost
city. Yeah. It's the non-copyright infringing city of gold.
Have you heard of the Netflix movie Finding Hoana?
No.
It's a Hawaiian film, and most of the cast are, like, Hawaiian. Mm-hmm. But, like, it is an adventure film, but it takes it from the Polynesian cultural perspective, and I think it addresses what you're talking about, where it does argue the efficacy of this sort of adventure tale.
Yeah.
If while also being a family-friendly entry into something.
I feel that if you're going to indulge in, again, what is easily described as a colonialist fairy tale that these type of adventure stories are, you need to be willing to interrogate the colonialism and the racism that, like you said, Vera, is inherently baked into the premise. Something I think Indiana Jones, which I could criticize, like, you know, there's lots to criticize in that vein of that franchise as much as I love it. But something I think that Indiana Jones, at least the first one, got really right was in understanding that it was ultimately and fundamentally foolish for these people to be seeking this out in the first place. and that if none of them had done anything, there would have been, if none of the white colonialists had attempted to look for this in the first place, there would have been no problems. They were the creators of their own problems.
Yes, although let me be clear, I love Indiana Jones too. So like I am being just needlessly contrarian at this point, and I will freely admit that. But the thing is, like, yes, that's true, but that's just because it happened to be an insta-kill MacGuffin, not because of the cultural disruption of their presence.
It was very accidental in the narrative, but I think that's part of why it holds up better, perhaps, than other entries into this genre.
Oh, I'd agree with that. I'm wondering if the best thing that could happen to the adventure genre would honestly be to hand it over to non-white people to take a crack at. And I mean, like, from the ground up, the screenwriters, the director, cast, like, Have it be people maybe learning about certain aspects of their own culture that's fading away or something like that, as opposed to these white people going in and going, oh, how exotic.
I've also always been a fan of the reverse Indiana Jones premise that people pitch all the time on social media. I'd love to see that for real happen about the archaeologist who breaks into museums to steal artifacts and return them to the people they were stolen from.
Oh, that's genius.
And it's like, yes, make that movie. I don't know why you haven't yet, Hollywood. But that's, you know, right, these are the ideas that people of that only people of color, like victims of colonization, I think are the best people to take over this genre, take the reins of it. I think you're completely right. And I really wanted to like the Jungle Cruise movie that came out. More so than I did, but, you know, it was fine.
Good job bringing it back. I'd completely lost the thread of how we got there.
How we got on this conversation is because I brought up the Jungle Cruise. But no, okay. Speaking, though, of a genre of
Segway.
People of color are taking the reins on, I saw the new Candyman the other day.
Yes, we are going to discuss the said
Segway. I deserve a trophy for that one.
Yes, you do.
Well then,
Lizzie, take the reins. Okay, what do you want to say? Yes.
So, y'all are gonna get to hear me go on my treatise about how much I love Candyman, the original Candyman, which is a thing that my girlfriend and my friend everyone has had to listen to all week. But the original Candyman is one of my favorite movies ever made. There's a lot going on in it. It is a film about, you know, the scar of slavery on American identity and how that never truly healed. It simply started to manifest in different ways, a la the ghettoization and redlining and criminalization of Black communities, right? That is largely what the original Candyman is about. At the same time, it's also this great operatic, romantic horror story. And I say romantic very much in the kind of, like, grand Shakespearean sense of just like that's kind of the emotion evoked through the score and the acting and the sort of vibe of the movie, not necessarily in the sense of romantic as like it's aspirational romance. It's not. People debate whether or not it's a slasher. I tend to lean towards no, just because I think it's so incredibly different and singularly unique in the way that it is. And it's a movie about stories and folklore and how legends and folklore shape communities and how the way we communicate with and the way that communities communicate with each other and pass down lessons to each other. And how the way we tell these stories and communicate these stories can affect our lives in real and tangible ways. That being said, as much as I love that film, and as wonderful as I think it is very, very extremely much a movie about race written and directed by white people. And that fact has always been really glaringly obvious about it. Not in the sense that they didn't understand what they were, the point they were making or what they were talking about, but just in the certain ways that the story manifests and is framed. It's very centered around whiteness. The main character is a white woman who by the end of the film is positioned as like a literal white savior to this impoverished Black community. So much of the film centers around Candyman being obsessed and in love with this white woman. Like it centers the issues of this Black community around how this white woman experienced it. So I was always super excited for the prospect of a Candyman remake from the perspective of Black creatives. I always thought, but like before Jordan Peele was announced to be producing one, I always thought that that was something that needed to exist. I always wanted to see the version of this story from that perspective. And so when it got announced that Jordan Peele's production company was producing a Candyman, at the time it was announced as a remake, but it's actually a sequel. And when Nia DaCosta got announced as the writer and director, I was just so excited. I thought this is going to be great. And to be clear, I feel like I'm setting it up to say I didn't like the movie. I liked the movie very much. I thought it was really, really good. I did not love it as much as I loved the original. But it was a very, very good movie. And I was super, super hyped for it. And I think maybe the problem was my expectations were just really, really high.
I think your expectations can often kill the excitement of a new entry in a franchise or a new iteration of something. Because I'm gonna step in and say that I agree with a lot of your love of the original is really good, but I have an opinion that I like the original, and I don't think it necessarily in my enjoyment of it doesn't necessarily all come together. I don't necessarily think it's that great of a film. Even though I understand where it's trying, and it has some really amazing themes, but I am on the perspective where I went in feeling that way and absolutely adoring this new film, and I actually think it's way superior.
So, like, here's one of the things I wonder in terms of your expectations, Lizzie. I think this is sometimes the hazard that happens when directors who are really, really good end up serving as producers on things. Because, like, on the one hand, it's a good thing because they're using their clout to, you know, maybe buoy somebody else who needs a shot or to help get made a project that wouldn't otherwise get made. But it's very easy when you see produced by Jordan Peele, or, you know, back in the day when he was producing more than directing, produced by Steven Spielberg or whatever, to think about the movies they've directed and have that be your point of comparison when it really shouldn't be.
That's fair. I had gotten into many, many arguments with people on Twitter specifically about not overcrediting Jordan Peele's involvement in the film. Because that was an issue, a lot of people referring it to Jordan Peele's Candyman, and I was very much trying to be like, this is a debut theatrical release for a Black woman. As a director, you need to give her it's important that we give her the credit for that. But you're right. You're totally, totally right, which is that you see Jordan Peele's name and your brain makes assumptions.
Yeah, you can understand that intellectually. You understand he didn't direct it, but like at some gut level, your brain is still going, ooh, Get Out, ooh, Us, ah.
No, that's fair. I mean, that's I'm sure how a lot of people, you know, like perceived and felt, and in a way, I didn't. Like, I knew his name was attached, but I almost kept forgetting that he worked on it. So maybe I didn't have that expectation, and maybe my perspective on it, it's different from Lizzie's for that reason. Yes?
Well, I guess it's also, I really like and understand the direction that Nia DaCosta was going with the movie. The elements that she was really, like, because the elements that she was really trying to push forward and bring out from the original was one, obviously, the racial subtext. I really, really liked taking this, what in the 90s was this extremely ghettoized redline neighborhood, and showing about how now, almost 30 years later, it's been completely gentrified, and shining a light on the effect that that has on communities. I thought that was a great way to move forward in a sequel when you're still setting it in the same neighborhood. And she's also trying to really expand the idea of Candyman as a folklore figure, less as a singular spirit of a singular person, by evoking a lot of other tales of Candyman and getting a lot more into how myths and legends are formed within communities and the function that they're supposed to serve within those communities. So I thought that was really, really interesting, and I liked the direction she went with that. What I think the main thing that disappointed me with the movie, if I'm going to use the word disappointed, might be that the murder scenes, I found them to be, they're just so different from the way that the kills were constructed and shot and presented in the original movie. It's a different woman. It's a different woman directing the film. But
I was gonna say I haven't seen either. But doesn't that just come with having different people behind both films?
Yeah, it tonally fits strange to me in the film. I found that the killing scenes felt like they were pulled from an entirely separate franchise from the movie I was watching. They felt very Halloween. They felt very like they were out of a more conventional slasher than I think Candyman is.
You think so? I didn't necessarily feel that way. Honestly, I thought it was kind of unique in a lot of ways that the original necessarily wasn't. I mean,
I don't know how you don't view the original as unique, though. The original movie, nothing else I could ever say is like the original Candyman.
Right. There is, but the kills are still kind of slashery kills.
Yes. But I guess to me, in the original, had a lot to do with the framing and the purpose of because the kills in the original from the actual Tony Todd Candyman were personal, right? They were very motivated and they were very related to the story and to Helen, right? As they all served the function of basically driving Helen insane. And in this one, the kills, with the exception of like two of the kills did that, and then there were a bunch of other kills that just were existing and happening separate from our narrative and separate from our main character who's supposed to be descending into madness. And it felt like it just felt disconnected, and it felt, like I said, like much more like a generic type of slasher format.
I'm really trying not to go into spoilers because I know some people on here haven't seen it, obviously, and I don't want to spoil it since it's so close to the release. But I see what you're saying, and I get your perspective, but I also feels like it fits with the narrative theming that it's going for. And you brought it up, the idea of folklore, of myths, and how they spread and the function of that. I feel like it kind of strengthens that a bit. You know what I mean? Like, that it's about more than just the individuals in this particular, like, the protagonists, you know? It's about the the myth in general.
I also just, and I hate the criticism of this horror movie didn't scare me, I think is a lazy one, but I also just didn't find the killing super, super terrifying. I thought, I unfortunately found the way that they kind of rendered Candyman throughout most of the killing scenes to be a bit unimpressive, which bummed me out. Because when you watch Tony Todd in the original movie, it's horrifying, it's terrifying, and he's actually covered in bees, and the practical effects on his in the inside of his coat is gorgeous and hideous, and then it's just so good.
I think what you're experiencing is a difference. Like
it's different, and I'm not trying to say that that's bad. I just, the thing for me is the thing that always made me love the original, and I guess it doesn't surprise me that this is the thing they took out, because it was the, also led to the most problematic elements of the original film. But the thing that I always made me fall in love with the original Candyman so much is that, like, epic, seductive, romantic element of Tony Todd's iteration of Candyman.
Okay,
so are you just trying to say that you're attracted to Tony Todd? Because, like,
well, yes, that's obvious. Yeah. He follows me on Twitter. Tony Todd follows me on Twitter.
She's a breathing human being. Of course she thinks he's right. Come on. But
speaking of Tony Todd, he's going to be Venom. I'm excited.
Allow me to make a very strange comparison, because I feel like the experience you're having where you're like, no, it's good, but it's just not connecting to what I like about it. You're reminding me of the experience I had watching Blade Runner 2049.
Interesting. Okay.
Which is a very good movie, but I didn't particularly care for it because by its existence and the narrative that it chose to tell, it was missing the one element that I loved most about the original, which is that in the original, the people we were following, these characters, do not matter. They are not important. And I have always been highly captivated by anything that can create this massive, grand, all-encompassing, immersive world and then have the boldness to tell a small story about people who do not matter. Like, honestly, the only person who probably matters in any kind of grand historical scheme to that story is Terrell. And that's it. The main characters are insignificant people. What is going on matters to them, but not on any grand scale. The story was not scaled up to match the scope of the visuals. Whereas I feel like in Blade Runner 2049, it was. I feel like the importance of what was going on was scaled up
to meet the visual world. What you're saying. The what you're describing about the original Blade Runner reminds me a lot of what I love about the Discworld series.
Hmm.
And the tendency, and obviously there's a lot of grand scale things that happen in that series, but a lot of my favorite entries into the Discworld series are the smaller scale stories about the extremely less consequential characters and the less consequential, just the smaller scale intimate personal stories.
Yeah, but I mean, even beyond that, it was like I watched Blade Runner 2049 and I'm like, this is gorgeous. This is great. And if you had called it anything other than Blade Runner, I would probably love it. But because you called it Blade Runner and you're missing that one thing that I love about the original that maybe nobody else even thought about, but I love, I now am somewhat disconnected from this.
I
saw both Blade Runner films recently. Yeah, it took me a fucking while to see the first one, right?
You've never seen it before?
No, not until like a few weeks ago or so.
That movie's as old as I am. God damn.
But
my dad was just watching Blade Runner last night. It's just so funny that this is coming up right now.
Yeah. I remember that while I wasn't 100% into the first one, it was more that it was a new experience and I wasn't expecting it to be this kind of movie. And it's a movie that needs time to grow on me. And to be fair, in the time since I've seen it, it has grown on me a bit. But then we watched 2049, because this was part of a movie. This was part of a movie night group I was a part of. And I just remember being so uninvested in everything that was going on. And I didn't find the world that interesting. I don't know, just it exists. it is a world that exists as a setting for this movie, even though it's supposed to be the same world as what was in the first one. And I thought it was well performed, with the exception of Jared Leto, who I am shocked people were calling this a redemption performance from him when this was just as bad as his performance in Suicide Squad.
It was not as bad, but it was not redemptive.
He was fine. Like, he should have hated his job. I thought it was fine.
I don't know. I, he does the way. I don't know. Maybe it's. I'm gonna be. I'm gonna be an actor snob for a second, because maybe this is because this is my profession, but I'm just, every time I saw Leto on screen in any movie he's in, not just this, but it was especially noticeable in this, it doesn't feel like he's talking to anyone. He is in his own head for the entire time, and he doesn't act with anyone.
Yeah, I think Jared Leto is, as the biggest flaw he has, just as an actor, is that he's way too self. He's got too many flaws as a human being. But as an actor, I think he's far too, the flaw he has is the most detrimental to his profession.
Right, and it's because the guy has a massive fucking ego, honestly. But
he's far too full of himself, and he needs to position himself as the most important element of every film he's in, regardless of whether or not he actually is.
Which is even the case, like, because I remember in Justice League, in Snyder's version, this was the same deal in his performance as the Joker, and he only had like a few minute scene in that movie. So and he
a
was
a few
in,
minute scene which meant nothing.
Oh yeah, no.
I have not seen the Justice League, the Zack Snyder's Justice League. I've seen that scene though, and nothing.
It doesn't.
As diehard Harley Quinn fangirl who will walk into a burning building barefoot to defend the honor of that character. The concept that she was just this crying waif in Batman's arms pissed me off. I wanted to strangle Snyder. I was so angry about it.
That entire sequence, like, it's weird because that entire sequence is like at the end of the movie, along with this other bizarre scene that takes place in the present day and not in a vision. And it's like, neither of these scenes had any point in the movie. You could have ended it without them, and the movie would have been fine.
That scene was horrendous. Like, I'm sorry. Like, it was one of the worst scenes I've seen. Like, legit. Like,
even people I know who legitimately really like the Snyder Cut tend to agree with the sentiment that the last two scenes, the nightmare sequence and the bit with Martian Manhunter, because the movie's been out long enough, people know, so I don't care. But like,
and if you haven't seen it, you don't give a fuck, so it doesn't matter.
Right. Like, the last two, like, anyone who wanted to see it saw it day one, so.
Yeah, exactly.
But like the scene in the nightmare sequence and the scene with, like, Martian Manhunter, they're the two most pointless scenes in the movie, and they are also, ironically, the worst scenes in the movie.
See, here's what's really weird about those scenes to me. So, like, first of all, while I'm not going to say I'm a massive fan on it, I liked that movie a hell of a lot more than I thought I would, given that I don't think I've liked a Snyder movie since 300.
Yeah, I think it's an enjoyable film, honestly.
Yeah, but what's really bizarre to me about those is that both of those scenes had to be shot for this cut.
Yeah.
All of that was footage that was not shot originally. What's bizarre to me is, even if you're going under the guise of this was the movie I originally wanted to make, he has to know they're not going to let him do this again. The only reason they let him do it this time was because they were going to be able to recycle a crap ton of footage, and the timing was such it was going to help them boost their
HBO
streaming
Max.
Service.
Yeah.
He has to know this confluence of events isn't going to happen again. So why would you shoot and include stuff that exists only for setup for a movie you will never be able to fucking make?
It also just leaves a bad impression, like, just leaves the movie on a bad note, because I initially didn't like Snyder's Justice League, but then when I kind of took some time to reflect, and then I thought, okay, if I divorce these last two fucking pointless-ass scenes from the movie, did I enjoy it overall? And I thought, yeah, I'd say so. I liked it. It was, but those two scenes just drag it down tremendously because they're not needed, and because there's not going to be a direct sequel to this movie, no matter what you fucking do. Just wait, I might eat my words later. Just cut to a year from now. That'd be funny.
I do want to specify that I actually quite... My vibe on Zack Snyder as a person is pretty positive.
Yeah, no, I like... I think he seems like a chill dude.
He seems like a pretty nice dude. Especially, I don't remember exactly what it is he said, but he basically said something that super shut down the misogynist dude bro fan base that was...
Yeah, he... he stood up for Asian Americans like right before the premiere of Justice League. So
he did it on a live stream where he called out the people who were hosting the fucking stream.
That's a fucking power move, honestly.
Father move.
Like, okay, so Zack Snyder seems like a nice person, and I'll even say, I think he has talent as a filmmaker, honestly. I think he does. I just think he needs someone to reel him the fuck in sometimes. Because there are times where even in some of his worst movies where I'm like, you have an idea here, you're just not executing it well. Okay.
Guys, real quick, have I shared my great film student shame about Zack Snyder on the podcast yet?
I don't think so.
If you are about to defend Sucker Punch, oh dear God!
I never saw it, so I'm backing out of this argument.
I felt it in my soul. Someone is about to try and defend fucking Sucker Punch. God damn it!
No, I'm not gonna try and defend it necessarily. But I like Sucker Punch. I enjoy watching it.
Here's what I will say. Here's what I will say.
I'm not trying to say it's good. I just
Here's what I will say. The good version of that movie is one where every single dialogue scene is removed. And it is treated like a 2-hour continuous music video, and it is done strictly through visual storytelling. That is the only way to even approach that being a good movie. There's still a crap ton of problems with the visuals, and that is trying to deconstruct the fetishization of the female form in media, while also simply being an example of the fetishization of the female form in media. But the narrative is what completely falls apart from top to bottom. If you could remove the narrative and have it be weird and abstract and kind of take it in a bit like how I prefer to take in, say, Tron Legacy, I treat it like a 2-hour Daft Punk music video. And it's much better if I pretend it has no story.
You are correct. That's the thing. That's part of why I find Sucker Punch so interesting, is that I think that is Zack Snyder. Exactly what you said. He's trying to and he didn't do it successfully. But I respect his attempt at the deconstruction of this type of fetishization of female characters. I respect the point. Like, I respect what he was trying to do a lot. And I wish what that film needed was more creative involvement from women.
Mm-hmm.
I think would have improved it a lot. But like it's not good. You're right. What I love about it is largely the visuals. Also, if I'm going to be entirely honest, that movie came out, I was a little baby bi that looked at the trailer, and I was like, I see pretty girls.
Now, see, that is the most legitimate defense you've said so far.
That's it. Oh, that's 90% of why.
I was this
baby queer kid watching the trailer and seeing the posters and being like, pretty girls in pretty costumes. I want to watch this. And
I know plenty of people who enjoy it. Like, it's so weird. It's actually weird because I've met a few people who enjoyed Sucker Punch. So, and I never saw it. So I was, I have been told to watch the director's cut, which seems to be a pattern with Zack Snyder's movies, to be fair.
He should stop trying to make 4-hour movies for studios that aren't going to let him make 4-hour movies. There's a thought.
Well, no, because the thing is, like, there was a lot of bullshit with production on Sucker Punch, from what I could tell, where basically they had to cut a lot of scenes to secure a PG-13 rating, which is what the studio wanted. So, and like a lot of what they asked them to cut shows such a double standard in fucking Hollywood. So.
But that's an issue with the MPAA, which is a whole different conversation. And like, look, I appreciate the intent of what he had, but like, I also appreciate the intent of what Rian Johnson was trying to do with The Last Jedi. I still don't like the damn movie.
Well, you're wrong, but okay.
Oh, that's a controversial statement, Vera.
Okay, so here's where I have to be very careful about what noose I'm sticking my neck in. Because there's a very long list of reasons other people hate that movie that either I don't care about those things or have nothing to do with why I think doesn't work. if I'm going to give you the main philosophical reason, because honestly, I'm going to have trouble backing up my logistical arguments anymore because I haven't watched it since it came out. I have videos out dissecting the logistics much more, but the core philosophical problem with it that I have is that it is a deconstructionist work. In and of itself, not a problem, but the very nature of a deconstructionist narrative is to break something. It is to pull it apart. And I do not think it is a good idea to do that with the canon representation of something. This is the exact reason why when Alan Moore wrote Watchmen, he originally had it with a whole crap ton of actual existing characters that DC Comics had just acquired. And DC Comics looked at the pitch and went, we love the pitch, but you cannot use these characters because you are going to break them in a way that will mean we cannot ever use them as they were intended ever again. So you need to create original versions. And I think of almost every great deconstruction story that I can think of, it's either with analogs to the things that it's deconstructing, or it's some sort of alternate, it doesn't really count universe. Things like Superman Red Sun or Batman The Dark Knight Returns or what have you. In some way, it doesn't count so that you can break it and make your point without actually breaking anything.
I think that is a horribly flawed analysis on deconstruction on deconstruction works, honestly, mainly like because I don't, how do I explain this? I think you can still do it in a pre-established work, and I think The Last Jedi did it well, and if they had us and if they had continued off of what was done in that movie, I think the sequel trilogy could have potentially ended with a bang.
Oh, I'm sure as shit not going to defend Rise of Skywalker. Let me be very clear about that. As much as I did not like The Last Jedi, and I've never wanted to watch it again, I did want to see where the hell you go from there. And where they went was completely around
ignoring it.
To stick their nose up their nap.
I'll sit back and not say anything.
I'll just give my two cents on your analysis of deconstruction. I don't disagree per se, because that was one of my biggest critiques, actually, of Snyder's Man of Steel. That frustrated me a lot. And Batman v Superman. That was what frustrated me a lot, is that, like, I don't want my Superman, you wasting time with my actual Superman movie to talk about how you think Superman is secretly terrible. Or how you are terrified about the implications of Superman in the real world. I don't need that in my actual canon Superman movie. So I don't disagree. I just think that the way the deconstruction of Star Wars was handled in The Last Jedi was a thing that was actually necessary to the franchise.
I think so too, because Force Awakens, I enjoy The Force Awakens, but my big problem with that movie is it did play things a bit too safe. It didn't, like...
And I thought if they had stuck the landing with the third movie, that would have been fine.
Yeah, that would have been fine.
That first movie played it safe. The second one deconstructed our understanding of the universe a little bit, and then the third one could have been good.
See, like, here's the thing. Part of my problem with The Last Jedi is honestly not even The Last Jedi's fault, because The Force Awakens set certain expectations, and this is reflective of the way that they were made and the fact that these people were not coming up with a coherent core idea for three movies. They were, well, originally three filmmakers all working on their own shit. But part of the problem, so, like, for instance, the fact that Rey, her parents are nobody.
Which is brilliant.
I love that on paper. However, it does not work as a follow-up to a film where you built that up. Because
I thought it worked great.
I heavily disagree.
Because they have entire swaths of the previous film, both plot points and thematics and these massive things. And if it was just her trying to find out herself, that's fine. But I'm talking about the framing. I am talking about the way the narrative was built, was to make you care and then to come around and punch you in the face and say, fuck you for caring.
That's not what they were doing.
I don't think that's what happened.
That's not what they were doing.
I said what I saw. the first trailer for the first Force Awakens trailer, I hope she's not related to anybody. I wanted that, but they set up the opposite and then did the other thing. And I'm sorry, that is a fuck you gut punch that doesn't work.
I'm sorry.
I don't agree with that at all. I don't even think this is an issue of opinion. I just think this was just lack of understanding of the film. Force Awakens did not build up anything about Rey's parents. In fact, I kind of got the impression as we were going on, it's like they just kind of the identity was irrelevant. What the important thing is, they're not coming back. That was the point of The Force Awakens, because that was part of Rey's character arc. And
I'm just gonna say it. I think
that it made total sense that her parents were no one, and it worked fine.
Okay. Yeah, I think Star Wars is breaking our show.
This is why I don't talk about it anymore. But anyway, I agree with Jazzy, but I'm gonna say this. I came out of Force Awakens, and my entire take, my whole ass hot take for the whole two years, year and a half, whatever it was in between those movies, was I don't want Rey's parents to be anybody important, because there's no answer to that question that isn't boring.
Or fan fiction-y, or both.
Yeah, there was no version of it that wasn't going to piss me off. So I was not piss me off. That wasn't going to be like uninteresting. I was like, I came out of Force Awakens genuinely thinking the best thing they could narratively do with her character is not have her be related to anyone. So I just have to disagree with you a lot on that there.
Again, please understand, it is the absolute correct narrative choice. It is
that
not
they went built, to undo after the film.
It is not. Well, I ignore the third film. Third film doesn't exist. They never made it. They stopped.
After I'm glad we can at least agree there.
There is no Rise of Skywalker in Bossy's.
I'm glad we can. You know what? Let's just all agree. You know what? I actually have to go. So why don't we end this heated argument by just saying, let's just agree that Rise of Skywalker didn't fucking happen.
I will agree to that.
Harmony.
And on that note, I would love to debate. I would love to continue discussing The Last Jedi because this is fucking fun. But at the same time, I have shit to do. Unfortunately, this is one of the few times where my obligations in voice acting are now getting in the way of Gals of Geekdom. Hopefully, it doesn't happen often.
Oh well, I hope I didn't blow out your voice by everything getting so heated.
Oh no! It's gonna take a lot more than that to blow out my voice. My voice is strong.
It's all well and good that things are going well in your voice acting career, Jazzy, but you cannot let that obfuscate the priority of this podcast.
Then why did you bring me? Why did you bring me here? I made it clear on day one that I do that. If it comes down to it, my voice acting comes first.
And with that note, Jazzy, you should probably get to your very important voice acting that is so really important that it's more important than me. It's okay. I'm not going to cry. I'm all right. It's fine.
I talked about Furious 7. I did the thing. What do you want from me?
All right. Well, Jazzy, we love you, and we will see you on the next episode, okay?
See y'all next time for Fate of the Furious.
Okay. Bye, Jazzy.
Bye.
All right, now that she's gone, we can talk shit.
Yeah!
Oh, man. Can you believe she talks about Fast and Furious just all the goddamn time? It's just like, so, enough of it. Just, so much. Oh.
And you know what people should do? People should spam her comment section with GIFs of the shame lady again.
Yes, do that again.
Game
of Thrones shame. Vera, we've had definitely not had people go to her account and send shame GIFs before. No,
we
that never happened.
We should not promote harassment of our friends on Gals of Geekdom.
Now, just out of curiosity, was there any context for why that happened? Or was it just a thing?
There was context. I simply don't remember it. She got something. Or other, it was like something of. It was a context. There was.
There always is a
It just gets lost.
It gets lost, like this show. Are you having fun? Are you having fun?
Yes, I am.
I'm glad. I was like sitting back, going like, oh my gosh, they're fighting on my show. Oh no, what did I do?
See, like this is the thing. This is why I'm glad I am talking with other geeks, because like. I've had shit happen when I'm talking to people who either aren't on my wavelength or aren't used to me, that like I would get worked up because I have a lot of thoughts and I have ADHD and I have to say it when I think of it, otherwise it's gone from my head. So like I will get
on. Sarah, why are you saying my exact existence right there?
Yeah. Well, my point is I will get on these tears, and people who aren't used to me or aren't on a similar wavelength, I've had them think I was upset. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm on a roll. I'm not upset. I'm not mad. I'm fine. So, like, yeah, I know that I can come off as intense sometimes.
Well, I mean, your thoughts and stuff is why I watch your content. You know, it's so I get it. And I kind of I don't think Liz or Jazzy quite knew, but that's totally fine. Our show is weird and freeform, and it's not the only time we've had arguments and disappointments, like how last week I disappointed everybody.
What did you do last week?
I may have not known the famous music from Phantom of the Opera.
Oh yeah, that's when I bitched about the Phantom of the Opera thing.
Ooh.
No, there was just this like 17-year-old on TikTok who was like trying to who was basically treating the opening song from Phantom of the Opera as like some sort of, I don't think, because it was going viral on TikTok, and she was like, do all the people using this sound know that this is from Phantom of the Opera? And it's like, yes, it's the overture from Phantom of the Opera. It's the single most famous 2 seconds in the history of musical theater. Everyone knows. You're not special for knowing this is from Phantom of the Opera. And it had me really pissed off.
And then I was like, yeah, I totally know
so
what you're talking about.
I'm going to totally go out on a limb and say it pissed you off because it made you feel old.
I'm 23!
I know. The point stands. Some teenager on TikTok didn't know or thought they were special for realizing a thing that to you is super fucking obvious.
Motherfucking kids. God damn it.
Look, I'm gonna be 40 next year. If you think I haven't gotten used to this line of mental bullshit, you're nuts. I have a 10-year-old. I'm doomed.
No. Oh my god, what's that like?
It's a thing. Enter with caution. No, I love my kid. What? I don't know why I have to caveat that. She's not gonna listen.
Are you sure about that?
She doesn't care.
She so does not give a shit what I do. Like she understands that I'm a YouTuber professionally, and like I'm in my office a lot either shooting or editing, but like she does not give a shit.
I mean that's a humbling thing, right?
Like well yeah. it can't not be.
Right.
Listen, your 10-year-old is not okay, so I presently work at a Target. And I get so many parents coming in to return clothes that they bought for their, like, 11 to 15-year-old. And it's like, oh, she just doesn't like anything I buy for her. No shit. No shit your 12-year-old doesn't like the clothes you're buying for her. Bring her to the store and let her pick. And I had a dad who was talking to me about how, like, oh, she just always wants to wear black. I wanted to get her to wear brighter colors. And I just wanted to say to him, like, I'm like, it's not my business to say this to parents. But I really just wanted to say to him, the worst thing you can do is try and force her to wear brighter colors. Because she wants to wear black and dark colors and dark everything. As one of two things. It's a phase that she will eventually grow out of. Or it's an authentic thing that she wants to, that she will pursue and she will get classier with and get more skilled at and will be able to present probably less shockingly than it appears.
No, it's not a phase. I'm going to continue wearing this despite you for the rest of
my life. That's the thing. Because the worst thing you can do, if you make, like, that's the worst thing you can do. Because she's going to
she's either going to start to get super insecure about doing it now, and that's what happened to me when I was a kid. My parents made me feel terrible about wanting to look like that in middle school. So I went through college looking like a middle schooler, a middle school emo kid, because I went through my emo phase in college.
I went through my emo phase on the job. I was working at a bar in Boston, and this was when I first started going out femme presenting. But the thing was, I was working at a bar where most of the trans or drag queen people, and I'm not equating the two. I know the difference, people, but there were drag nights and there were trans people who would show up. Most of them were people of color. They were Black or they were Latino. But what that meant for me is who I was surrounded by. I'm like, I can't really be taking inspiration from you because, like, it's not my culture and it's not going to work on me, on my pasty ass body. And so I thought, well, what's something that I can do where I can explore presenting more feminine that feels white? And the whitest thing I could think of was to go goth.
Yes.
So in my early 20s, working at a gay bar in Boston, I went goth.
Well, that's awesome, though.
Thankfully, this was before the days of digital photography being ubiquitous. So there are, and like way before people had decent cameras on cell phones. So very few pictures of this. Thank fucking God. Like, I can make the look work now, but oh boy.
You know, we all have to explore to find ourselves, you know. And
there's gotta be rough patches. Holy shit.
And of course with us, you know, not being cis, it's like we're experiencing our puberty in these stages way later.
That does go back to the point I was making though, right? Is that like they're either gonna look awkward doing it now or they're gonna look awkward doing it in 10 years. Like, you're not doing your kid any favors by not letting them explore this right now as a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
You, as the parent, need to take the brunt of the embarrassment about however you feel about how they're presenting so that they don't get, so that, like I said, but if they still are vibing with this type of aesthetic 10 years from now, they're going to be doing it well. They will have learned how to present it well. Otherwise, it's going to be terrible when they're an adult, and you don't want that.
let me say this. Thank God for low lighting in that bar.
I'm sure it helped, but
oh god, it's life saving, because I'm pretty sure under harsher lights I would not have made any tips.
Well, you never know. Hindsight's 2020, right?
Yeah, my girlfriend needs my attention. Okay. So I also have to run now.
Okay, well, at least we got this nice little conversation about being queer for the last 10 minutes.
Love it. Vibe with it.
So I think it's good time to wrap up the show. Lizzie, do you want to plug your stuff?
Yes, you guys can. Anybody can follow me at Lizzie Lemon Drop on Twitter or TikTok. Are going to be the main and interesting places. On Twitter, I post things that I write. If you follow the link in my bio to the website, I work hard on them when I actually bother to post them. So please go ahead and read that. You can follow me on my TikTok, which is 90%, as I always say, 90% shit posting. But sometimes I talk about movies and other interesting things that are relevant to my field of expertise. My girlfriend just said lots of yelling.
Those are my favorite.
So, there's lots of yelling, mostly at people for being trans or biphobic, because those are the things that tend to piss me off the most.
True.
All right.
All right. Well, Vera, do you wanna plug your stuff? Let people know where you can be found and all the good things.
Okay. Let's see if I can do this in one breath. For my Video essay stuff, you can look for Council of Geeks on YouTube. That's my most polished material, and it's also what my Patreon supports. So you can find Council of Geeks on Patreon if you want to help me actually pay my bills and eat. You can also find Council of Geeks on Instagram and Twitter for more random stuff. There's the Break Room of Geeks, which is a subsidiary channel which deals with reviews and is a little bit less polished. And for stuff on my gender fluid experiences, you can look for Vera Wilde. Wild spelled W-Y-L-D-E. Dang it. And that is on YouTube, Twitter, and TikTok.
Yes, and geek fans, go listen to all that stuff and find the videos and follow all that because it's awesome. And I am your other lovely co-host, Crystal Williams. I am a writer. You can follow my Medium account where I occasionally write articles about social issues and also some geek stuff. It's basically whatever I want to do. And you can follow me on Twitter at CrystalWRocks. And you can also find the other podcast that I occasionally go on, the Violet Wanderers. So you can go do that and follow them because they're awesome. But with that being said, and definitely follow Lady Jazzington on Twitter just to plug her stuff.
Oh yeah, she left and then didn't, without plugging anything.
Without plugging. So yeah, she's a voice actress.
You've got to get the plug inserted smoothly before you leave.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, we just don't usually have someone just have to take care of something important in the middle of our show. Damn it, Jazzy.
I mean, you know, I suppose it's the unexpected plug that you have to watch out for.
Yeah, it's just kind of like just shows up out of nowhere.
Yeah, it doesn't feel right to just shove it in out of nowhere, you know. Oh, well.
I'm not going to make an innuendo on that comment.
Come on!
That's our show. And with that being said, thank you so much for being on our show. We will love to have you back, and maybe you and Jazzy can duke it out some more. I'm kidding. I really do hope you've enjoyed being on the show. We really do love having you.
It was a great time. Thanks.
All right, and with that, we will see you on the next episode of the Galaxy Geekdom podcast. Bye, everybody. I know that some people will fucking do that.